491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFDRadio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California to New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 333, recorded on Sunday, November 15th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
So before we get into our topic this week, just a quick announcement. We will be having more information on this soon and certainly talking about it on the website at arsenalfordemocracy.com. But we wanted to let folks know that the show will be continuing in January of 2021, but it will be in podcast-only form instead of being on the radio station. Obviously, we've been on the radio station with some interruptions, but almost continuously, or at least I have, since the fall of 2011, 9 years ago. And I've been doing radio stuff with WVUD since 2010. And it's been a huge opportunity, so many valuable chances to learn skills that I wouldn't otherwise have been able to learn. They've been such wonderful hosts to us, but we are going to be taking the show in a bit of a different direction. The stuff that you like about the show will be continuing in the podcast-only format, but we will be adding some things. We'll be tweaking the format a bit, having a bonus episode each week, changing the length of episodes, so they'll probably be more like about 37 minutes for a typical episode, or if it's like a really long topic or a long guest interview or something, it might be like an hour and 15 minutes, which is about twice that length. We'll have a lot more information as we get closer to January, but including this episode that you're listening to, there will be 6 more radio episodes that are that 25-minute roughly length, and then we will be transitioning to the podcast-only format, which will, as I said, will be quite similar to what we have been doing over the year 2020 on the radio show, but also similar to what we did with the Lend-Lease podcast version in 2019. So we're really looking forward to that. There's going to be a lot of exciting changes. Like I said, we think that this is going to double down on the stuff that people are enjoying and expand into some new areas that people will also be really interested in. Thanks again so much to WVUD for having us all this time, and we'll be continuing with them through almost the end of December, and then the last week of December we will take off to work on reformatting the show and getting everything ready for the podcast-only reboot in January. So with that being said, let's get into our topic this week. We're going to be talking about 2 very successful strikes in U.S. labor history. That's the kind of stuff that you can certainly expect to hear a lot more about when we go to the podcast version of the show. These are the coal strikes of 1902 and 1919. And because of the success of the 1902 strike, as Rachel is about to tell us about, there wasn't a tremendous amount of strike activity in the coal industry between 1902 and 1919. This also has a lot to do with some of the later steel strikes that we saw, including the one we talked about a few weeks ago at some length, the Little Steel Strike of 1937 and the Memorial Day Massacre. But while we've talked a lot on this show about unsuccessful strikes, this week we're going to be talking about 2 strikes that worked out pretty well overall for the striking miners. In this case, first the anthracite coal regions, and then in 1919, the bituminous coal regions. So, Rachel, why don't you tell us about the strike in 1902 in anthracite coal in the United States?
Yeah. So first, a little bit of background. I'm not a coal head, so I wasn't aware of this before. So anthracite is quote unquote hard coal. It burns more efficiently and then burns with less smoke than bituminous coal, which is like quote unquote soft coal. So it was really popular as a heating fuel just because of that high heat index and then also the less smoke than soft coal. So the coal strike of 1902 occurred between May 12th and October 23rd. Of 1902. And so it really threatened the nation's winter fuel supply, which really led to the the pressure to end the strike before winter occurred. It was the first major labor dispute mediated by the federal government acting as a neutral party. So that was pretty big. So a little bit of history. There was a bituminous mine strike in 1897 and also minor anthracite mine strikes in 1899 and 1900. These strikes increased labor power for the United Mine Workers of America. However, as we've kind of seen in our past industrial history episodes, anthracite owners were a lot more formidable due to the formation of an oligopoly. Fluctuations in the coal market led to consolidation of ownership. So the same process that we've seen in oil, steel, and railroad industries, they just became a bigger force to reckon with. In 1900, the United Mine Workers struck for wage increases and union recognition by the mine owners in September of 1900. The owners refused to negotiate until J.P. Morgan met with them to persuade them to end the strike so as not to hurt President McKinley's re-election. So kind of the capital and politics kind of shaking hands, scratching each other's backs to get things done. The strikers in that strike got a wage increase, but they did not get union recognition. And this effectively kicked the can down the road until 1902. So in 1902, John Mitchell, who was the president of the United Mine Workers of America, they were seeking, again, wage increases. They were also seeking an 8-hour workday, which is down from 10 hours. And also, again, they were seeking union recognition. George Bayer, who was the president of the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad, and also a big owner in these coal mines, absolutely refused to negotiate with the union at all. John Mitchell did suggest mediation by the National Civic Federation, which was a group of progressive business owners who actually approved of collective bargaining as a means to resolve these labor disputes. As the strike wore on in June of 1902, President Roosevelt was getting really worried about this coal strike, kind of foreseeing the disastrous consequences if there wasn't enough coal for the winter. So Roosevelt, again, this is Teddy Roosevelt, not Franklin. So Roosevelt sent his Commissioner of Labor, Carol Wright, to investigate the conditions of what was happening. So Wright's report actually recommended a 9-hour workday and limited collective bargaining as a compromise. Roosevelt actually hid the report to not appear too pro-labor, but as the strike continued, he just kept getting more and more worried. And he even considered nationalizing the mines and putting the U.S. Army in control of the mines, which is kind of surprising to me. So J.P. Morgan, kind of reprising his role from the 1900 strike, at the behest of Secretary of War Elihu Root, reached out to George Bayer to persuade him to agree to arbitration by a commission. All negotiations would occur through this commission, so Bayer wouldn't have to recognize the union, basically. He would just put forth all his negotiation through the commission. The commission consisted of 7 members, a military engineer, a mining engineer, a judge, an expert in the coal business, and a, quote, eminent sociologist. The mine owners were willing to accept a union leader as the eminent sociologist. So Roosevelt named E.E. Clark, who was the head of the Railway Conductors Union, as the eminent sociologist. Catholic leaders exerted pressure, so then a 6th member was added to the commission, a Catholic bishop, John Lancaster Spaulding, and then Commissioner Wright was the 7th member. So both parties agreed to this commission, so the strike ended in October, and then the Anthracite Coal Strike Commission immediately got to work. They toured the coal region, and Commissioner Wright used the Department of Labor to collect data on the cost of living for the workers. The commissioners held hearings in Scranton, Pennsylvania over the next 3 months, and they took testimony from 558 witnesses, including 240 for the striking miners, 153 for non-union mine workers, 154 for the operators, and 11 called by the commission itself. There were closing arguments. George Bayer made the closing arguments for the coal operators, and then lawyer Clarence Darrow, who we have talked about on a few previous episodes, made the closing arguments for the workers. So the commissioners heard evidence of terrible conditions, but they concluded that the, quote, moving spectacle of horrors represented only a small number of cases. So by and large, social conditions in the mine communities were found to be satisfactory, and miners were judged as only partly justified in their claim that annual earnings were not sufficient to maintain an American standard of living. In his closing arguments, Bayer said, quote, these men don't suffer. Why hell? half of them don't even speak English. And then Darrow used his rhetoric skill, for which he was famous, saying, quote, "We are working for democracy, for humanity, for the future, for the day will come too late for us to see it or know it or receive its benefits, but which will come and will remember our struggles, our triumphs, our defeats, and the words which we spake." So in the end, the commission really tried to kind of split the difference between mine workers and mine owners. The miners had asked for a 20% wage increase, and most were given a 10% increase. The miners had asked for an 8-hour workday and then got a 9-hour workday. And the operators refused to recognize the United Mine Workers. They were required to agree to a 6-man arbitration board, which was made up of equal numbers of labor and management representatives, and they had the power to settle labor disputes. Mitchell considered that de facto recognition and basically declared it a victory. In the aftermath, the behavior of the private coal and iron police, which attempted to break the strike, and they did actually kill a striker as he was trying to walk away from the police. So their behavior led to the formation of the Pennsylvania State Police in 1905. This was signed into law by Governor Pennypacker. Union membership soared for both the United Mine Workers of America and the AFL. So their behavior in their strikes was kind of contrasted with the violent strikes of the Western Federation of Miners, who we have talked about in the past. So they were seen as kind of more acceptable, more respectable, I guess, than the Western Federation of Miners. And Roosevelt used the success of this commission in providing a, quote, square deal as his motto for his administration. And then there were no major coal strikes until 1919, which Bill will talk about.
Yeah, so is there anything else that you think people should sort of take away in terms of the legacies here or anything like that? Obviously, the huge significance being the federal government taking on this new role as a potential arbitrator between the striking workers and the owners.
Something I did want to point out as that was kind of reflected from Bear's closing arguments, there were a lot of workers that didn't speak English. They were immigrants. John Mitchell was really successful in bringing those kind of ethnically diverse workers into the union. So that was kind of seen as a blueprint for success for labor, bringing in a wide coalition of miners.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I think we see in a lot of U.S. strike history is the failed ones were unions that were racially segregated either explicitly or de facto and didn't make any effort to incorporate immigrant, Latino, and African-American workers who were then available as a flex labor pool for strike breaking. And the ones that were successful tended to be the ones that had incorporated other people better. And in general, unions or union federations that made more of an effort to incorporate those other people besides the native-born white English-speaking workers, they tended to be more successful in the long term.
Right.
So as you said, I found that there were definitely some coal strikes that happened between 1902 and 1919, so it wasn't completely absent. But I think in terms of overall activity, it was relatively dormant. And of course, maybe things would have kicked off a little bit earlier than 1919 if it hadn't been for the war effort and the war restrictions. But overall, we arrive at 1919 in a very interesting position. And this is, I think, maybe I haven't done enough research on this one, and maybe I'm just missing something big. But this one is a rather puzzling strike. And I think there's a couple key factors here that will help explain things that maybe wouldn't necessarily be explicitly clear. But for some of this, I'm going to have to speculate a little bit. So I hope people will join me on that attempt to figure out what had happened here. So we did talk a few weeks ago, as I said, about the 1937 Little Steel Strike. And I mentioned in that a lot of the steel worker organizing efforts of the 1930s were actually backed by the United Mine Workers. Now, you might be wondering, well, what's the connection between the United Mine Workers and the steel working efforts? And there's two explicit connections that you can see the roots of it in 1919. One has to do with the failures of steel organizing in 1919, and the other has to do with the fact that bituminous coal is used, or at least bituminous coking coal is used in the production of steel. So if you're a unionist with the mine workers, you look at that and you see a supply chain connection, much in the way that, as Rachel just talked about, the railroad owners wanted to vertically integrate the supply chains from the anthracite coal to their railroad businesses, to their shipping businesses, and so on. In this time period, everything was about these supply chains. And one of the challenges that a lot of union activists had, as we've talked about on numerous episodes this year and last year, is that that if you are trying to successfully organize a strike, one of the things that helps it succeed is if you can get other parts related to your industry to be on strike at the same time. That could have potentially happened here in 1919, but it ultimately did not. And I'm guessing that part of what happened in the aftermath of that was that by the 1930s, you know, a decade or so later, decade and a half, the United Mine Workers leadership, the important people were basically the same in 1919 as in the mid-1930s. They concluded that in order to have success with their potential mine strike activities, they also needed to have control over the steel industry, to have more control over the overall supply chain, to have more political effect and economic effect. So as Rachel said, there was reduced strike activity between 1902 and 1919, but then there was this huge strike, ultimately successful, from November 1st, 1919, about a year after World War I, to December 10th, 1919, so about 5 weeks. Somewhere around 394,000 to 400,000 coal miners in 21 states, representing about 64% of all bituminous coal miners, went on strike. The result of this was a 14% wage increase, despite court injunctions and a bit of a falter by the newly acting head of the United Mine Workers of America, John L. Lewis, who we'll circle back to in a bit, who at one point tried to call the strike off while it was in progress, but he wasn't really listened to on that, and ultimately the union prevailed. So let's look at the context for when this strike happened to try to figure out what were the factors working for it, what were the factors working against it. On paper, there's a lot of reasons to expect that this strike would have been a disastrous failure, and so it's interesting that it actually succeeded, or at least succeeded to the extent that they got their 14% wage increase, which was, you know, more than the wage increase percentage in that 1902 resolution, and that they seemed relatively happy with the outcome when they went back to work. So, things that were happening at the same time. First of all, this occurred during the first Red Scare. Again, that's a factor that you would think would be working against it. That the Red Scare, the first Red Scare, as we've talked about, ran from January 1919 to April 1920. So this is smack in the middle of that. And during this coal strike in 1919, many of the newspapers dutifully repeated the mine owner claims that the strike was being funded and directed by Lenin and Trotsky themselves, at least according to research by Robert K. Murray in his 1955 book, Red Scare, A Study of National Hysteria, 1919 to 1920. Another thing that this strike was happening during was Woodrow Wilson's incapacitation from stroke, which happened from September, and then again in October, he had a worse stroke onward. And again, this coal strike kicks off in November of 1919 while he is basically fully incapacitated. And I'm about to come back to that, but let's keep going through just so people understand the overall context here. Technically, there was a continued state of war at this point. There had been an armistice or ceasefire in November 1918, a year before. This was repeatedly being extended, as we've talked about on other episodes, through the peace treaty negotiations for the Versailles Treaty and the other related treaties. The U.S. officially didn't end the wartime powers that had been granted over things like food and fuel, which of course affects coal, even if we're talking about coal for industrial production. Those were extended until March of 1921, and the U.S. didn't officially declare the war to be over completely until July of 1921. These wartime powers gave extra emergency powers to the government, and specifically Attorney General Palmer, who of course was involved in the Palmer raids of the first Red Scare, and he claimed that he had Woodrow Wilson's consent to invoke these powers against labor activity that was happening in 1919, although I'm going to circle back to that in a second. And this was despite promises that had been explicitly made and were basically provable to the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, that they wouldn't use those special wartime powers to break organized labor. And Palmer claimed that not only had Wilson signed off on this, but that the entire cabinet had agreed to the invocation of these measures to crack down on this strike and another strike that was happening. And the labor secretary basically disputed that outright and was like, I didn't agree to that. And also I told the AFL that this wasn't going to be used in this way. The other thing that's happening, which again is the biggest factor of why you might expect this strike to end in disaster, was the steel strike of 1919. So on September 22nd, so this was before the coal strike started, the steel strike kicked off, but it collapsed on January 8th, 1920. So this started before the coal strike and it ended after the coal strike had ended. And unlike the coal strike, it ended pretty disastrously. The steel strike was led by the Amalgamated Association of Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers, and this was a skilled worker strike. This was their final attempt to recover from the sort of damage that had been done to their union in the Homestead Strike in 1892 that we've talked about so many times, and a fiasco in 1901 where they tried to organize at U.S. Steel, which was, you know, as we talked about, this giant steel monopoly or near monopoly, as opposed to the little steel companies that we talked about in 1937. And they won almost all their demands from U.S. Steel and then thought, oh, I bet we could get more, and kept pushing, and instead lost everything. And it was a complete disaster. However, the coal miners in Pennsylvania played an important role in the steelworker organizing in early 1919 by going on strike to protest local governments refusing to allow steelworkers to rent space for meetings on the pretext of controlling the spread of the third wave of Spanish flu in early 1919. Now, initially, it looked like the steel strike might be relatively successful. The steel companies were shocked by how widespread the steel strike was over how many states, etc., especially because the AFL had been pretty incompetent in how they had approached steelworker organizing in the run-up to 1919's strike, and they weren't really completely behind the strike, and they also didn't really like letting local workers make decisions as part of this. So this clearly started off on kind of a weird foot, and the steel companies basically recovered relatively quickly from that initial uncertainty about how big it was, and they realized that they could probably crack down on it. So they started this huge propaganda campaign in the public to denounce the striking steelworkers as dangerous immigrants and communists, and they focused a lot of attention on William Z. Foster, formerly of the IWW and the future General Secretary of the Communist Party USA after World War II, and he was considered to be unusually dangerous because during World War I, and still at the time in 1919, he had ongoing efforts to integrate every single union related to the meatpacking industry in Chicago, and so he was the big threat to them, and they managed to really successfully paint him as a total villain who had to be defeated. The AFL, as I said, was broadly unhelpful both in the run-up to this strike and throughout the strike, and you can read a detailed analysis on the factors in the failure of the 1919 steel strike in an article from history.com that we will include in the notes with this episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com. So again, there's a lot of reasons to think that this strike might not have worked very well. Now, with the 1902 coal strike, Rachel talked about how there was concern that they were going to run out of heating coal for the winter, but that was an anthracite coal strike. This is a bituminous coal strike, so there wasn't as much concern as to whether or not there would be shortages of heating coal in the winter when this was happening. I mean, this was November and December. So even there, again, not something that necessarily was working in the favor of this coal strike. And so I was sitting here doing the research and kept on wondering, well, why is it that this strike actually worked? And I think what it comes down to is to go back to this point about the way that Attorney General Palmer was handling things and Woodrow Wilson's incapacitation from stroke. I think we are able to at least see a potential answer here. When the strike was resolved, and I looked up the New York Times headline and article about this from 1919 in December of 1919, supposedly there was an agreement proposed personally by Woodrow Wilson to resolve this strike. Now, it's a little unclear still, even to present day, the extent to which Wilson kind of was incapacitated or knew what was going on or who was making decisions around him. And the timeline is a little fuzzy too, because at some point, some people did manage to go eventually talk to him. My guess on this is there is no chance that Woodrow Wilson would have been able to negotiate any sort of resolution to this strike. He hadn't been incapacitated really when the steel strike had started in September of 1919. That was no longer the case when the coal strike happened later in the year. Attorney General Palmer was able to crack down pretty hard on the steel strike, and he tried to do some of that with some success in the coal strike, but I strongly suspect that what happened was they realized that if this strike was allowed to continue, and it was not on the back foot in the way that the steel strike was, that it was going to become increasingly a pressing question as to where President Wilson was, why he wasn't speaking out on this, and who was actually in control in his absence. And there was already these rumblings, as I said, from the labor secretary that he did not agree, and that therefore there was not unanimity in the cabinet as to what to do about these strikes or what even the legal authority was to respond to these strikes. So it is my suspicion that what happened here was they decided, and we don't know who actually proposed this, but it almost certainly wouldn't have been Wilson. You know, maybe it was Palmer, maybe it was one of the advisors in Wilson's inner circle, maybe it was Wilson's wife, Edith Wilson. Somebody somewhere proposed a solution, said it came from the president, and that they convinced the owners of the coal companies, all right, we need to wrap this thing up. You've got to give in to this. This can't be allowed to go on because it's going to create much larger problems. They knew at this point that the SEAL strike was probably not going to work out, and it was certainly not going to work out if they could prevent it from linking up with various other strikes. 5 weeks into the coal strike, they figured, okay, this is a much stronger strike. Let's try to nip that in the bud by coming to a resolution because it's better if we just resolve it. Again, I can't prove that, but that is my speculation about what happened. Final 2 points that I wanted to make here as we wrap up. After the 1919 strike, the United Mine Workers of America continued organizing more miners with based on their success of the 1919 strike. It's great for recruitment. But from 1920 to 1921, there was spectacular violence in West Virginia, specifically Mattawan, perpetrated against the miners by the owners, including shootouts, assassinations, including a local police official. And again, these were assassinations not by the miners, but by the owners and their private detective agencies. And there was even a private plane bombings. They would fly over and dump bleach or try to bomb the union headquarters and so forth. And eventually President Harding had to send in federal troops to intervene and stop this. And there's an article on the Smithsonian Magazine about that. And you can also go, after COVID-19 is over, to the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum in Mattawan, opened in 2015. The other thing to know about this is that, as I said, John L. Lewis, facing some of the sort of prosecutions and court injunctions and threats against himself and the United Mine Workers, kind of choked a little bit under the pressure during the 1919 strike when he had just taken over as acting president, and he tried to call off the strike. Nobody really listened to him. It worked out fine. But that was an uncharacteristic kind of misstep or uncertain step from him. And he went on to rule the United Mine Workers of America with essentially an iron fist for 40 years, including through the Great Depression and World War II. And he controversially expelled socialists and other leftist radicals during the 1920s, before then inviting some of those leftists back to participate in the organizing drives of the 1930s and the Congress of Industrial Unions, which takes us back up to that 1936-37 period and the 1937 steel worker organizing and the little steel strike of 1937 that we talked about previously. That is all the time that we have today. Again, some of this is a little bit speculative on my part with the 1919 strike. We know a lot more details about what was happening with that strong presidential approach from Teddy Roosevelt in the 1902 strike. Rachel, thank you so much for coming on this week to talk about the 1902 and 1919 coal strikes in the United States.
Glad to be here.